How to bridge the gap between psychology and architecture. Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski, and this is the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities, and many more. Today we have extremely interesting topic with a special guest. We will talk about bridging psychology and architecture and why is it vital for user-centric, inclusive and sustainable design. My guest's experience helps architects integrate psychological principles, foster a deep understanding of how buildings and spaces impact well-being. My guest today is My Luncio, who is an expert in behavioral design with a background in architecture and a master's degree in environmental psychology. She works as an associate and behavioral design specialist at Danish-based firm Frixen GXN, where she integrates psychological insights into architectural design. Today we will discuss the growing interest into how buildings impact the users, with an emphasis on inclusivity, sustainability, and well-being. We'll talk about the important psychological principles for creating user-friendly spaces, we'll talk about safety and designing for multiple senses. We'll also draw on the importance of integrating interior and building architecture to create user-centric designs and the key psychological principles that enhance the user experience. And last but not least, we will discuss the main topic of this episode, which is about bridging the gap between psychology and architecture, making research accessible to architects, and very importantly, translating the complex psychological research into practical design recommendations. I'm very happy with this episode. I learned a lot, and I hope that you will learn a lot as well, no matter if you are a designer or not. Welcome to the newest conversation with My. Let me start with saying that I'm so happy to have you here, My. Welcome to Urbcast.
Thank you. I'm super happy to be here.
We are sitting in this very small, cozy room, yes, recording this podcast, and I think that this is a very good reflection of the topic that we're going to discuss today. I would love to discuss how can we bridge the gap between psychology and architecture, and I think that this is such a brilliant topic. And as you will develop it later, I hope we as designers, as architects, but hopefully also as society, we pay more and more attention to psychology, our physical well-being. And I think that this is a very important topic to discuss in the midst of challenges that we have as well and mental health issues and also how architecture can influence those. But maybe before we start, you could say something more about how you got interested in the topic and the behavioral design and architecture as well, because it's actually both, right? It's two-in-one package.
Two-in-one, yes. I think my interest, it started with an interest in architecture. And I think at that time, that's like, 15 years ago or something? More, I guess, 17 years ago. I was a bit naive, actually. I watched too much movies and series. I have this very romantic vision of what an architect are working with, you know, making some sketches, drinking some wine, being a bit inspirational.
Maybe some of them now.
Maybe some of them are. So I got into architecture school, which was fine, studied in Denmark. And then I think when I graduated 10 years ago now, and I started my first job, I kind of got a little bit of a reality check. I think then it occurred to me that the working with architecture is actually a lot about sitting in an office and working in front of a computer, doing like drawings, 3D models and so forth. And I thought like, oh, why on earth did I choose this profession? Because I'm not particularly interested in computer work or sitting, you know, at an office all the day. And I really enjoy talking to people and meet people and be out and about and so forth. So I kind of had a little crisis where I thought that this profession actually was perhaps not my purpose, or what do you say? I also felt that when designing in an architecture studio, there was a bit of a lack of focus on the people we are designing for. I thought that a lot of the conversation was, of course, it's on function. I mean, if the building is functional or not, but it's not so much about how it is perceived, how it addresses the user's emotions and how they're influenced through the design. And therefore, I started to search a little bit more towards courses at university to figure out how can I somehow address this. So, and I found some very nice courses in two universities in Sweden, in environmental psychology and general psychology. So I applied for those, and then parallel to my working as an architect, I started studying at the university, much more academic and focused on psychology. And then in the end, I became a master in environmental psychology. So, and in that sense, I think for me, that really made the profession make sense for me, because then I could focus on people and also be creative with design, kind of merge, two topics.
I love when my guests have those challenges that they just graduate and then they think that they will do what they were preparing for many years. And then suddenly they start and they see that something is off. But yes, I feel like this is so great that you had this courage to look out for something that might be this additional layer that you developed into your strength later on. And this is something that I would love to discuss with you. So on a daily basis now, after you said that you don't like working in front of the screen that much,
yes.
how does your work look like when you work with the behavioral design and environmental psychology, but still in an architecture office and probably still working with buildings, with public spaces? How can you apply this lens?
Yes, it's actually, I think now it's a perfect mix, because what I do is I do a lot of kind of reading research articles, kind of like getting to be a little bit diving down into a bubble and see what's going on in academic institutions and read that knowledge. And then the best part is then I can actually take that with me and go over to the architectural teams and start to collaborate together with them. And what I do is actually a lot of the time I have workshops with the architectural team. I sit together with them in design meetings and discuss. I also do drawings and design guidelines in that sense, but not really actual building design, more inspirational diagrams and topics we can discuss and presentations. Then I do a lot of presentations and meeting with clients. I'm out trying to understand both clients' needs and the needs of users, and also some actually field studies where I would come to a site and register it from also a psychological perspective, not only the traditional architectural field study where you map, you know, people flow and so forth, but also a bit more the psychological one. So in that sense, I have a very varied workday now. So it's, I think, less than half of my time is actually screen time in that sense.
So you are successful on that field as well.
Yes. That's
it's less than half. But at what stage of a project does your work start, and where is it the most influential one? Would you start with analysis before the first sketches appear, or would you join on the later stages rather?
Yeah, I think ideally it would be from the beginning and throughout the whole process. And sometimes even before the project, I mean, before the project start with program visioning and understanding the users, their needs and so forth. So I think the earlier, the better. But then, of course, there's reality. And a lot of the time we're not involved right at the beginning of a process. We come along. It depends very much of if it's a project that FreeXN is doing that I'm supporting, or if it's an external project. And sometimes we're aboard very early to talk with the clients about their needs and so forth. So it's very varied. I think it makes sense from the programs. Like, I mean, how would you place a program in a building? What sort of program do the users need? What sort of a building do we want? I think so from the very visionary perspective, but then also very much down to the details. What sort of colors are on the wall? What I mean, so for me, it's in all scales. It's relevant to consider those aspects.
How do you enhance inclusivity and accessibility in design?
I think, well, for me, that's one aspect I'm actually very interested about. How we enhance it, I think of it a lot about, it's about the dignity. I mean, the world around us, it constantly sends us kind of subconscious messages and that affects us. And I think that's both the opportunity, but also very much the responsibility of design. So of course, we should make sure that everyone can move around in our design and feel that it reflects their value. So I think that's more an ideological point. And then for me, how I will work with it is to actually engage as much as possible, as early as possible with the designers, but also to talk with users from various perspectives, I would say. Think about children, think about elderly, think about various types of disabilities and all sorts. But I think diversity and inclusion is a huge topic on its own almost, but it's something I'm very aware of and we are when we work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a broad topic, and I'm aware that with this discussion we might not cover many parts of it, but this is just some kind of an introduction to the topic. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, I think it's extremely, extremely interesting to think about how psychology and architecture can be intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've been preparing for this meeting, you've also emphasized that this is so important to engage multiple senses in design.
Mm-hmm.
So while we design, while we discuss with the clients, with the users, we also need to talk about those invisible things.
Mm.
Can you tell us something more about designing for those multiple senses?
Yes, I think that's actually a key topic when looking into, I mean, I tend to see my profession sometimes a bit philosophical almost, like we are those creatures, you know, those souls walking around in bodies on this sphere, you know, in space, the planet Earth. And then the purpose of architecture and design is, of course, to create structures that we can inhabit. And then what I do is actually that I reflect upon, okay, those structures we create for those souls walking around on this planet, how do they affect those souls? And I think in that sense, it's very basic. It doesn't seem strange that you would consider that, right? Yet in the modern society, we're so alienated from our bodies and what they actually need and our souls and so forth. And we, you know, for the last decades, we have this modernistic architecture where it's very much about kind of the perfect, the design is very white, it's polished, it's not so much varied, for instance.
Mm.
So I think now we can see really a counter movement towards that, where we have new types of aesthetics, where variations and imperfections, for instance, they're not seen as something bad, but something more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And with that comes a positive bodily response from our. So when we move around in buildings, that gives us varied sensorial input, our bodies are actually thriving because our bodies, they are developed to be in nature where there's a lot of variation and senses, and all of a sudden comes the wind and there's the soundscape, you have the seasons, you have everything changing constantly, right? So when our buildings and our designs start to reflect that, when you have, you know, tactile materials, you have soft curves that you can touch with your hands, you have soundscapes that are varied, you have possibility to regulate the light, for instance, we can really start to work with the connection between the bodies and, I mean, our senses and the environment, and that affects our whole mood and well-being and feeling.
If that's so natural and important, why do we have in our cities, why do we have so many anti-examples? So when I think about a shopping mall, once you go there, it's very unpleasant. There is a lot of artificial light, very, very bright light. There is a music that is very loud. And I feel like there are different spaces in our cities that are exactly the opposite of what you are just saying.
I find that super interesting as well. Why is that? And if we go back to my philosophical idea about being those creatures walking around here and then having those structures designed for us, it's so interesting that we haven't reflected more traditionally on how we're actually are influenced by the way we design. I guess it's because the building industry and designers have been so focused on other aspects of concepts, of theoretical concepts, of, you know, also, of course, capitalism, how you can build fast and much at a high speed and mass fabricate. And I think at some point when this whole mass fabrication and possibility to create those more perfect, you know, in the sense that everything looks the same and so forth and can be built quick. When that came, I think perhaps people were at that time a bit seduced by the idea that everything was very like new and fresh and so forth. But then it's kind of evolved in a not so pleasant way for humans.
But while applying all those sensual design ideas, talking about the color, shape, light, and architectural experience as well, isn't it making the design process more complicated because there are so many other things you need to think of, and it also costs money?
Yes, exactly. Definitely. Yes, definitely. So I think that's the challenge when I work with architectural design teams. They are, you know, overwhelmed by collaborators in a sense, because they need to take into account, you know, building regulations, the client's needs, and now there's all those sustainability certifications, for instance. There's engineers, there's fire regulations. There's so much for them to take into account. So I feel like their mental capacity and the architect is kind of the spider in the web of that very complex process, right? So I feel like their mental capacity is at a stage where it's difficult for them to incorporate yet another aspect unless it's presented in a very accessible way. And that's why I think the workshop format, for instance, is a very good one, because then I would prepare, I would do, you know, all the research article reading and prepare what would be relevant to focus on from a psychological perspective in this particular project. And then I would kind of make a nice workshop out of that where they can work with some themes and gain a sense of ownership of this aspect as well of design, but where they won't be forced to read a lot of documents or make checklists or, you know, because there's plenty of that.
So talking about applying this knowledge in the real world, I'm very curious about how could you... You've mentioned the workshops and you've also mentioned the research that you are doing, but still... I wonder how can you translate those complex psychological ideas and research into practical design recommendations? Because I will be just a bit skeptical and then will say that one workshop will not be enough for someone just to suddenly start thinking with those psychology glasses on.
No. Okay, I think that's a spot on question. It is, because that's the whole problem. I think also if you think of the nature of architects and designers, it's a very intuitive-based profession where you work with experience, you're learning while you're doing, you're very focused on like a current challenge you have, and then how you can use architecture and design to solve that challenge, basically. So you very much work with design and architecture as a tool, and it's an iterative process, you know, where you're looping back and forth on different directions and so forth. And on the other hand, you have psychology, which is very traditional academia in many senses, and is typically published in research articles. And also a lot of psychological articles are very much like, in this trial, in this specific settings, with this particular user group, we got this, you know, response or something. So it's very far from each other, those two fields. And I see my role very much as being the bridge between them. And it's not enough that I take, you know, go to Google Scholar and find the 10 most relevant articles and then I dump them at their table and say, read this, and then you implement that. That won't work. So it's very much, and I think a lot of academias, they are very afraid of trying to make it tangible because they're unsure if it then loses its validity as research, I would say, because it's very difficult to research, you know, to prove something which is about humans and the science and so forth, because how could you make sure that it's the color that influences a person, for instance, or is it, I mean, how do you account for all the other factors? And then you need to do it in a laboratory study. And then, so there's a lot of kind of issues in the nature of the two fields. So I think what I'm doing is that I'm working as this bridge, and I give myself some freedom to say I'm working with applied research. Me, myself, I'm not doing research. I keep an eye on what's going on in research institutions, and then I take that knowledge and I make it, and then I look at the project at hand, and it's very difficult. And as you said, it's super complex. So what I feel is like for every project, I don't try to cover it all. I say for this particular project, we're going to focus on one thing or two things. You know, it might be the journey of children moving through that building. And then that's what we're going to focus on in this project. And then the rest You can say when I work with FreeXN now, I've been working here some years and they were used to having us from GXN interfering with their or working together with them in the design process. So in that sense, they have a lot of knowledge themselves already in how to incorporate this. But then we would have a certain focus. Mm-hmm. And then that's what you focus on. So then you would have, in that case, a workshop with the focus of children and children and movement. And then you can have multiple workshops on that. Mm-hmm. And then I can take research on that topic and make it a little bit more inspirational for the architects to work with. So I guess it's very much about narrowing it down and give yourself some freedom to say. And then I'm also saying, okay, maybe it doesn't get perfect because it is very complex psychology, you know, to make it tangible, it is very complex. So perhaps it's not perfect, but just that we're addressing it through those workshops and are working with it and that the architects are focusing on it is a huge step forward, right? And then we will gain more and more knowledge of what actually works, you know, in a real life setting.
I would like to have more people like you working across disciplines. I think that it would help us all if we were kind of thinking about how it is to look from a different perspective. You've mentioned that you apply some knowledge from GXN into FreeXN. Mm-hmm. And for those of the listeners who are not familiar with your firm, can you just very briefly describe how it works with applying this knowledge in your company?
Yeah, it's always a bit confusing with the FreeXN, GXN. FreeXN is kind of a traditional architectural design studio, if you can say that. And then GXN has existed for the last, I think, 15 years or so. And it's an independent design-driven research studio. That's what we call ourselves. I think the key thing with GXN is that we are working with pioneering the building industry, working with innovation. So, and often we're connected to one of FreeXN's projects or several at a time. And then it's a bit up to us. I think that's very unique with GXN. And then it's we can figure out ourselves how we want to address what topics we want to address and how we want to address it. We have a bit of freedom to work within the projects. And in GXN, we're very multidisciplinary. And some people in GXN, they're more towards research. Others are more kind of designers. Others are just like the bridge, like me, myself. And we work not just with behavioral design, but also circular design and more environmental topics. We have engineers and so forth in-house. But I think the good thing is that we have the freedom. So what I do when I'm working with a project together with FreeXN is that I will, you know, join the design team and then I will listen to them and see what challenges are they facing and what do I consider the most important to address here from a user perspective or a people perspective. Sometimes because it gets more and more focus on it, the client has a focus they want to address and we can start working with that. Sometimes because I've been working now for some time together with FreeXN, they already know some of the knowledge I have and they know that, oh, we want to work with this tool you have or this approach that you have, or we saw your presentation on this, so we would like to address this.
I wanted to touch upon safety.
Yes.
And curiosity and the aspect of designing restful spaces and also how can we apply those psychological principles in designing the way how we use the space, how we sit, because there's another challenge. Recently at Henning Larsen, we've published Urban Mind research project, which was about the well-being of teenage girls.
I have seen that.
And I think that that was spot on because it was addressing the real challenge that is there in spaces that the teenage girls might not feel comfortable, might not feel safe in the public spaces, might not find spaces that basically are fulfilling their needs. And talking about safety in general, how would you approach the challenge of safety and how we use the space with applying the behavioral design and psychological design rules?
I think safety is a very important topic today. And I think also it's actually a topic that is highlighted a lot in urban planning as it is. But often you think about safety in terms of like traffic and so forth, and also lighting that you feel safe in a space. Of course, there should be safety for instance, teenage girls, that they feel like they can hang out without being exposed, that the activities are addressed for them and their needs and so forth. I also think from an environmental psychology perspective, though, that it might be a challenge that we are focusing so much on safety that sometimes we kind of forget the aspect of exploration and mystery. And those two are kind of contracting each other, but both of them are needed to create a space that are pleasant and interesting for us. So I think, for instance, if you have a plaza which is very safe, you can sit here, there is light, there is so forth, there's always a little bit of a risk that it gets a bit, I'm not sure if boring is the right word, but a bit too similar to everything else, you know, there's not much to explore. And I think that's a challenge in urban planning, modern urban planning, that some of the spaces we create, they are not truly interesting because they lack an aspect of mystery and exploration and richness. So if you think in urban planning, often when people are visiting cities around the world, you always go to the old towns. That's normally the areas where yes. people find a lot of interest, right? And I think from an environmental psychology perspective, that is because there you have the more meandering pathway, you have the, you know, perhaps the very narrow alley, you have the details, you know, the street lamps, they might have some ornaments on them, all sorts of things to explore, a richness in the facades, you have variation and so forth, and a much more, a scale that is much more related to the human scale. While in a lot of new city planning, I think there's a lot of focus on safety, but it also gets a bit boring because then you have straight roads, you have a bench where you can sit, you have some lights, but you don't have much to explore. You kind of lack the richness. And sometimes I think you want to be a bit intrigued. Sometimes you want to walk at a meandering pathway where you can't see what's around the corner. So I think there's a very delicate balance in addressing safety, but also not forget our urge to explore and to have some bit of curiosity when we move around in the cities, for instance.
The balance is a good word because let's consider a park, which is dark in the night, but we would like people to use it and feel safe. So then we put a lot of lighting around, but it might be the light that is too bright. So it basically kills the mood and the atmosphere of the park or wakes up all the animals and so on. So definitely, I think that there are many angles and many different things to think of, and trying to compromise in a way and balance is the attitude here. Could you share a case study from your work where you applied some of those rules, either around safety or psychology in general, to improve the well-being of the future users?
Yes, I think it's a bit difficult to give one example as an architectural project. I would rather prefer to talk about it through some themes and methodologies, and I can give some tangible examples of those. So when we look at behavioral design, I think there's several aspects where you would look at it. And that goes for every project, no matter how small, how big. So we would look at it from an individual perspective and saying, what does an individual need here? Then we would look at it from a more social perspective, like what type of social interactions do we want here? What sort of connections and interactions, yes, will go on between people moving around here? And then we have the larger scale, which is more the cultural and the societal, where what types of associations and meaning does this project have? How do people attach to it in a broader sense? So if I give you some examples of those and how we work with those aspects, I think that might make more sense. So for instance, if we look into the individual, that is very much about the right type of, I mean, to understand the core needs, and those will change a lot. So if you think of yourself, if you're coming to work a sunny Friday afternoon, you know, or you will be like happy, and then you will want to meet a certain type of workplace, for instance, or you would visit a certain place in the city. And contrary, if it's a rainy Monday morning, you know, you have a pimple on your forehead, you feel like you want to hide something, you will want a completely other type of setting. So the aspects of the individual is very much to give everyone that is influenced by our design some sort of agency and choice to what type of setting and atmosphere they're exposed to, and possibilities to regulate a bit themselves. And then out of that, there is, of course, a lot of research of what is good for the individual. So often we talk about nature, for instance, and biophilia, and that is good for us. But actually, when you look into it even deeper, it's not like nature, it's not just nature. So for instance, if you have a user group that suffers from severe PTSD or severe burnout, for instance, there are studies showing that it might be too much for them with plants or flowers. That might be overwhelming. I know this a little bit myself when I had my first baby and I sat in the couch and I suddenly told the father of the baby, like, we have to throw out our pottery plants because I can't handle anything more in our house having a demand, you know, needing my nurturing, because I thought, all of a sudden those pot plants, they didn't feel restorative to me anymore. They felt like something I need to water and take care of, and you know. And in that sense, so for instance, biophilia for someone that suffers from severe burnout, that might mean actually stones, like a Zen garden with stones, or touching a stone or something that does not require any nurturing. And then when that person starts to heal, they can start interacting with plants, and then you can add flowers. And even in some cases, the color of the flower matters, because some people, for instance, see red flowers as a bit more violent. And then, you know, there is therapeutic animals that you can engage with, and then you might be ready to engage more with people. So, I mean, it's just to say that even just thinking as a concept of biophilia would mean a lot depending on which user we are talking about and their mental mood and state of that day. So I think the individual aspect of design is very much to make sure that we create environments with variation of spaces so that you can choose yourself what type of space you want to be in. And that also goes for architecture. It's a lot about, is it like a protected pocket, or is this a big dynamic space with a lot of stimuli and so forth? And then if we move out one aspect, we say, okay, so that makes one person, an individual, being able to regulate themselves. Then for the social interaction, it's a little bit similar. So I think in an ideal world, you would be able to choose a setting depending on what type of for instance, conversation you're having. So for instance, when we're sitting right now in this cocoon-like meeting room, which is very small, that makes the conversation more intimate. So ideally, you would be able, for instance, at an office to book meeting room depending on what type of meeting conversation type you're having. Is it a brainstorm? Then you might want higher ceiling heights, more spacious, I mean, literally more space around you for your thoughts to think. While if it's more a confidential, intimate conversation, you might want a smaller room, and you might also want perhaps darker colors, more dim light and so forth. So, and it also goes that you should be able to choose between outdoor settings. You have another conversation if you do a walk and talk, and it will change also depending if you're walking in a park or if you're walking in an urban setting and so forth. So the tangible aspects there is also again about variation, but being able, so if you have a project, to determine what sort of social interactions do we want and how can we support that for providing kind of a palette of atmospheres and settings that can support all different types of interactions. Last one is more about understanding place attachment and how people are in large, if you zoom out, and a society, how they are connected to places and spaces. So that could be, if we're working with that, that could be, for instance, doing some master planning or a transformation of an existing area. And then to actually talk to users and understand which existing qualities are they attached to? What are people attached to in the area? For instance, is there a certain, I mean, sometimes it's very obvious you have a very famous landmark or something, but a lot of time it's those small things. There's like these benches that a lot of people are actually using, or this view spot here and so forth. And then you can start doing master planning by connecting, enforcing the connections between those, make sure that, okay, those are sacred places. We're not going to touch them. We're going to make them perhaps better and so forth, but we're not touching them, kind of sacred hearts. And then we can start building connections around and so forth. So I'm not sure if it was specific enough. It's that sort of things we're working with, and at different scales.
Yes,
and typologies.
You definitely mentioned some aspects. You didn't name drop the projects, but
no.
But at least you said something more about how you approach those. And I think that this is also very helpful. I would like to end on this inspirational note and educational as well. And I would like to ask you this one more question that might be difficult and quite broad, but hey, come on. I didn't promise that it's going to be easy. And this is about how can aspiring architects, young architects or architecture students, design students, integrate this psychological thinking into their architectural education? Because as we started, you said that in your case, it was that you've started with architecture and you've been disappointed, and that's how you found your way into psychology. So if you could share this 15 years of experience that you have now to someone who is just starting and got inspired now, what would be the step for them?
Oh, I think actually, I guess it depends very much on where your architectural education is taking place, actually. The one I did in Denmark, it was very project-based and a lot of freedom for you to choose yourself what you wanted to focus on. And I guess then it's easier to incorporate those aspects. I'm not sure how it is worldwide. But I think definitely that the best thing would be to find out what is your key interest. I mean, psychology is so many things. It's, you know, neuroarchitecture, it's environmental psychology, social sciences, anthropology, so many fields you could study. So I guess it's about finding whatever you find interesting. And then just don't be afraid to just, you know, grab a couple of research articles or read, speak to someone. We also do that sometimes, interview researchers at different universities and so forth, and actually ask them, can I use it in this way? Or what do you think? So I think it's just trial and error, and just try to get like some inspiration and not try to cover it all. I think that's the key point. So perhaps if you're interested in color, maybe that's what you're studying one project, like the perception of color and that how that influences the perception of a space. And then focus on that and see what you can find of research on that. And then just try it out and try to merge the two. Yeah, I would say it's about not being afraid of just try it, but don't try to cover it all. And I don't think any architectural project can cover it all. There will always be something which could be done in another way, or, you know, because it's just impossible.
And about something that can happen right now when someone got really inspired, a book recommendation. Could you share something that is ideally about the topic and will help the listeners to understand the topic even better?
Yes. I do have a very nice book with me, which is called Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives by Sarah Williams-Goldhagen. And I think what is great with that book is actually that she's very good in making research accessible about this topic. So she's very good in doing this inspirational aspect, like we're touching upon. How do you make research kind of inspirational and tangible? And I think she's doing a marvelous job in this book of creating and sparking an interest and explain it in a way that actually wants you to start working with those topics and so forth. I think that's a very, very nice book to start with. So perhaps that's the recommendation for students to read that and find your favorite interest.
Exactly. To start with the book, I will add it in the episode's description. And yeah, I will share anything else you find relevant. If you see any other interesting sources, I can also share them.
Yes.
As we couldn't, of course, cover it all in such a short episode, but I really want to thank you, Mu, for joining.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the newest episode with Mu Lunsu, that specializes in behavioral design and psychology and implementing psychology into architecture. As well, she's a part of FreeXN and GXN here in Copenhagen, and that was such a huge pleasure to learn from her. If you would like to get to know something more, please reach out to me and also to me. I'm happy to connect you with me, and remember to check the book recommendation. Thank you, and talk to you soon.